The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Pollock Invasion and the Father of Elijah, Mr. Neil Pollock. I met Neil about 6 years ago when he first appeared on this stage with Dave Eggers in 2001. His anthology of American literature had just been published, and Neil gave quite an interesting reading featuring several very filthy poems. We later worked together on the Philadelphia's 215 Festival of Literature and Music, which is still going on even though Neil has left us. Then he headed off to Texas, where he created and toured with his band, the Neil Pollock Invasion, and wrote Nevermind the Pollocks, and most importantly, became a father. His new book, Alternadad, is the story of Neil Pollock, the punk frontman, becoming Neil Pollock, the daddy, and of his experience trying to raise a cool, happy, hip kid without becoming Mr. Rogers in a Black Sabbath shirt. Please welcome Neil Pollock to the library.
Hello. Thank you, Sarah, for that lovely and accurate introduction. It's nice to be back in the Free Library, in this room that I've spent a lot of time in. I'm here to talk about and read from my book, Alternadad, which is a memoir of contemporary American parenthood, although I think a lot of the stuff I talk about in the book could apply to any parent from any time. Some of the sort of rock and roll neuroses that I display may be unique to this generation, but the scene, like the one I'm going to relay now, which is the prologue to the book, could really have taken place any time in human history, I think, with slightly different details. I was napping pleasantly on a futon one Saturday afternoon when my wife flung open the door. She held a filthy sponge in her left hand. A look of terrified desperation clouded her eyes. "Catastrophe," she said. "What?" I said. "Your son took off his diaper. He's throwing shit all over his bedroom." Oh, there's kids in the room, aren't there? Well, he's throwing poo all over his bedroom. Sorry, Maddie. I didn't mean to do that. And he's enjoying himself. "That's bad," I said. "It's disgusting, that's what it is. Now get out of bed and help me clean." I'd woken up with a kid who had just turned 2 at 6:20 a.m., and I was tired. Plus, allergies had mashed my brains into lentil soup. They call it cedar fever here in Austin, which is an insult to cedars and even to fever. It's horrible. My head was encased in a stack of hay. My eyes had been scraped dry. I needed a nap. No. I deserved a nap, but this situation required a dad. More profanity, so cover children's ears if that's right. "Damn it all the hell," I said, and I got up. Elijah stood in the middle of the living room. He was naked, flapping his arms and hopping around like a Packers fan on Wild Card Sunday. "Ah ha ha," he said. "Elijah bad." Regina was in Elijah's room with a roll of paper towels and a bottle of industrial cleaner. She scrubbed the wall next to his bed with unrestrained fury. Elijah had thrown his blankies on the floor. Little chunks of poo corrupted all three of them. "He smeared it all over the slats of his crib," Regina said. "It's on his stuffed animals. It's everywhere. I really think I'm gonna puke. I see carrots. Oh, no. There are peas and corn." This is very highbrow stuff. She wasn't looking at me as she said that. I think she was speaking to some kind of abstract god of parenting. Then she turned to me with a command. "Entertain him," she said. "Now." I looked at Elijah, who was cackling and turning in a circle. He didn't need to be entertained. He needed to be pacified. I turned on the TV. It was that Little Bear program where the Maurice Sendak-created animated bears are such a happy family, and they always solve life's little problems like getting lost in the woods or attacked by a puma. because their lives are based on sincere friendship and good judgment. Oh, how I loathe Little Bear. Regina emerged from the bedroom and pointed the sponge at me. Threat brewed in her gaze. You need to run him a bath, she said. Right, I said. She returned to the bedroom. I went into the bathroom and turned on the faucet. Elijah made a beeline down the hall. I grabbed him around the waist and twisted him upward. He howled with glee. Don't you dare, I said. Daddy, do, he said. He looked so cute, I just had to tickle him right then. Regina continued her attempts to contain the situation. She ordered me to put bubbles in his bath, even though I always put bubbles in his bath and wouldn't consider doing anything else. But I understood. Sometimes when matters spiral, you just need to control what you already know. By the time the bathtub was filled, the trauma of the afternoon had waned. Regina had picked up all of the larger poo chunks. She looked like a field surgeon 3 days after Antietam. All that remained was 2 loads of laundry. Do you want help? I asked. No, she sighed. Are you sure? Regina was the motor of my ambition, the bulwark of my soul, the apple of my eye, and the pearl of my heart. She handed me an afternoon's worth of our baby son's poop. Just get rid of this, she said. And I took it, because I loved her. I walked outside. The wind nipped. I was wearing a white t-shirt, gray boxer briefs, and black socks pulled up to my knees. Also, I was holding a plastic Walgreens bag full of human excrement. A chill gust stopped me for a moment, and I had a premonition. Someday, I realized, I'll look like this all the time. All right, so that's the introduction of my book. How many of you here are parents? And how many of you here have parents? All right, that always gets a better response. So the former may be able to relate from a slightly different perspective, but I think, yeah, I think everyone will understand and be able to relate to what I'm talking about next. As Sarah alluded to, I had a checkered literary career before I became the responsible Mr. Rogers Monkey that you see before you. I traveled around the country and to some extent the world as a character called the greatest living American writer, making fun of literary lions such as Gore Vidal and Norman Mailer and other august figures while doing nothing to actually equal their output. But it was a sort of a literary performance art and got me to certain places. And this is an account of my first business trip as a father. And it was during that period in my life. I was invited by the John Adams Institute of Amsterdam to be the American representative at Dutch National Poetry Day, an annual celebration. Because I'd never actually published a poem in English, I was a somewhat odd selection for this honor. In my home country, I generally performed my spoken word poetry parodies in front of a dozen people or fewer in the back rooms of independent bookstores. But in the Low Countries, several thousand people had witnessed my act in grand opera houses and cavernous, acoustically generous concert halls built to house acts like Oasis and Blur. Oscar, my Dutch publisher, thought that he might be able to cash in on this situation. Do you have to do this? Regina asked. It would be a great insult to the John Adams Institute if I didn't, I said. We have a 3-month-old baby, she said. Don't you care about him at all? Of course I do, I said. I care about him more than anything in the world. But I still want to go to Amsterdam. It's a fun opportunity for me. You just want to go to Amsterdam so you can smoke pot, she said. That's not true, I said. She looked at me, arms crossed. Okay, I said. It is true. But that's not the only reason. I felt a little guilty, not so much because I was going, but because I'd be going without her. Though I was going to be gone only 4 days, she'd be taking care of the baby by herself. She definitely got the short end of the transaction. For 24 hours in Amsterdam, I was a responsible representative of my country. Oscar had set up some interviews for me with such high-powered outlets as a monthly Jewish newspaper from Rotterdam. Also, as part of the National Poetry Day celebration, I and the other participants had each been assigned to write a fable, and to teach a workshop about fables to a class of high school students. I hadn't written a fable since I was 8 years old, and it showed. In a couple of hours, I slapped out a lame animal parable about tolerance based on the recent assassination of Dutch prime ministerial candidate Pim Fortuyn, about whom I knew nothing. Then I taught my class and chose, as the organizers had instructed me to, the best student from the class to give a presentation that evening. My student would compete against the other students from the other classes. If she won, she'd receive a prize. Up until 15 minutes after the lecture ended, I was sober. As I walked out into the late afternoon, I had 3 hours before I had to present my poetry in a public performance. Now, I decided, would be the perfect time to get high. But never do that, kids, ever. It's wrong. Amsterdam's coffee shops held no mystery for me. I'd visited many times and knew all the neighborhood spots, not just the places for Australian backpackers. Since I basically did nothing else when I was in Amsterdam other than visit art museums or eat cheese, I'd more or less memorized a stoner's walking tour that would have been the envy of the most experienced cannabis cup judge. When I next looked at my watch, 2 hours and 15 minutes had passed in a magnificent haze of high-octane legal weed and herbal tea. I'd enjoyed conversations with a one-armed Nigerian taxi driver and an anthropology professor from a low-rent Midwestern community college who'd just emerged from a two-day mushroom trip in his hotel room. I stepped out onto a major thoroughfare, full of confidence in myself, both as a professional and a dad. I pulled a picture of Elijah out of my wallet and thought cliches that were still true. I love my son so much. Look at him. He's so beautiful. Life with him is going to be a wonder. I'm the luckiest man in the world. To my right, I saw one of Amsterdam's many smart shops. These are less famous than the coffee shops, but their wares are more powerful, more obscure, and just as quasi-legal. I walked in, briefly pondered a display of homegrown peyote, bought a packet of some sort, and swallowed two pills with a gulp of water. By the time I arrived at the venue, my lips felt like sausages. Oscar gave me a conspiratorial grin. "How are you feeling?" he said. I couldn't tell him that at the moment I was imagining that my eyes had popped out of my sockets, shot forward 10 feet, attached by thin ligaments, wrapped themselves around my head, and reinserted themselves in new sockets that had opened up just above my eyebrows. He wouldn't have understood. So instead I said, "Oh, fine." I was second on the evening's program. My opening act was Gerrit Comridge, the poet laureate of Holland. This is a true story. As befitting his position and nationality, he was stern, angular, and slightly bemused. He wore mostly black and red in Dutch. This gave me a lot of time to ponder the fact that my legs were slowly melting into the floor. I wondered how I'd make it up to the podium without them, particularly since the rest of my body was slowly filling up with oatmeal. When the poet laureate of Holland cut his reading short because he had a train to catch, the MC introduced me as our, quote, distinguished American visitor. A film of dripping sweat plagued my entire body. When I took the podium, I was hot. "Good evening, people of the Netherlands," I said. "My name is Neil Pollack, and I am the greatest living American writer." With that, I lifted a pitcher of water off the podium and dumped it over my head. Oscar and his friends seemed to think it was funny, even if the rest of the crowd didn't. This gave me encouragement to continue. We were on the eve of the Iraq invasion. As I'd sat there not listening to the poet laureate of Holland, I decided to deliver a monologue of pure patriotic bluster to parody the misguided war fever that was currently gripping the United States. "I stand here representing," I said, "the greatest country in the history of the world, the beacon of democracy to oppressed people everywhere. Our enemies tremble in the face of our awesome military might and our international system of secret prisons that are accountable to no one. Our allies feel safe and comfortable under our broad protective wings. All hail the United States of America, where literature kicks big ass." A man in the back of the hall rose, shouted, "You will be punished," and stormed out. I later learned that he was the Iraqi representative to Dutch National Poetry Day. The rest of the evening was a mix. My student from the fable class gave a great presentation and won the prize, but then later on a panel, I compared a German poet to Hitler and accused the moderator of asking, quote, the stupidest questions of all time. When someone in the audience asked me what advice I'd give to young people who wanted to be writers, I said, "It doesn't matter what you say. If you say it loud enough and for long enough, eventually people will pay attention. Well, the moderator said, I'm certain we will now all live our lives according to Mr. Pollock's wise advice. Afterward, my prize-winning student came up to me with her parents. Thank you, her father said. You've really inspired my daughter. I have a son, too, I said. So I understand. So that's my account of my first business trip. I hope that none of you fathers out there or prospective fathers ever have to go through anything so horrible. Whatever that joke was supposed to be didn't come off very well. The book is set against the backdrop of what, for lack of a better term, is being called like hipster parenting culture. There's a sort of a generational tick among parents right now of a desire to teach their kids about music, and in particular about rock and roll. And I'm no exception to this. In fact, and a lot of parents I talk to have very similar stories. I find it amazing that I'll get an email from a dad who will say, hey, man, my kid's really into Wilco. Do you have any suggestions of what else I should play for him? And I'm thinking, and then I ask how old the kid is, and I find out he's 2. And I'm like, it really doesn't matter what you play for your kid. The fact that you're playing music for him at all is kind of a victory. Over and over again, it seems to be very important to contemporary parents that their kids listen to quote unquote cool music, which is cool in itself, but also kind of ridiculous at the same time. I play a lot of music for Elijah. We drive a lot. I live in Los Angeles. I play music for him in the car, and I also play music for him at home. And I'll describe just a little bit of that now. In those early days of driving music hour, as opposed to living room music hour, I played jazz for Elijah. He particularly liked the Max Roach drum solo on a Dinah Washington album. I also had an early 90s History of Funk compilation put out by Rhino Records. One morning, I brought it into the car. I opened with Jungle Boogie, which later became known in our house as Jungle Song. Elijah certainly enjoyed singing Get Down over and over again. Then, on a hunch, I turned to track 12, Play That Funky Music. When the song was over, Elijah said, again. When it was over again, Elijah said, again. Soon I was regretting ever having introduced him to Play That Funky Music, which these days at best is a barely acceptable wedding standard. There was no stopping his passion, though. Elijah screeched, monkey music, Daddy, monkey music. So I turned it on, again. He sang along, or at least he sang the last syllable of every word. I don't think his comprehension was very high, judging by the way he interpreted the chorus. Actually, I like his lyrics better. Play that monkey music, wiper. Play that monkey music, right. Play that monkey music, wiper. Play down that booger. Die, die, die. So that's a little taste of what my kid is like. I'm not going to read this particular section from the book because I actually don't remember what page it's on, but there's a little girl in the audience tonight who is, whose parents were sort of early inspirations when I lived in Philly, sort of alternate parents to us. And, her mom, was telling me a story today when I was having lunch with her, about how, one night, I think Maddie was 3 or 4 at the time, and, she and her husband said to Maddie that, Neil Pollock was coming over, tonight, and her daughter got really excited, and way more excited than anybody should get about me coming over to the house. She was just running around screaming, Neil Pollock's coming over, Neil Pollock's coming over. And so when I got to their house, she ran upstairs and got her copy of the book Olivia. You are all familiar with Olivia. She's this sort of precocious pig girl who does all kinds of funny, wacky things and has a great imagination. One of the things that Olivia does is goes to the Museum of Modern Art with her parents and sees a Jackson Pollock painting and does a Jackson Pollock painting in her bedroom. And so Maddie was under the impression that Jackson Pollock was coming over. And when I arrived, she was pretty disappointed, as many people are when I arrive. So I thought I'd share that that little anecdote because she's here and she's behaving herself very well. I'm going to read a section from the book about a a gymnastics class I took my son to. When we were living in Austin, we lived next door to a couple. He was a former wide receiver from the University of Texas, and she was his wife. Yeah, and glad to be it, I guess. And they had a kid about Elijah's age named Gavin, and Gavin was the kind of kid who likes to tackle things, and particularly liked to tackle Elijah. And whenever they played together, which wasn't very often, he would just go up to Elijah and just bop him on the head as hard as he possibly could, and Elijah would immediately like crumple to the ground sobbing, because after all, he is my son and not a wide receiver's son. So I decided that it was time to sort of man up my kid. And I took him to a place. I signed him up at a gymnastics class that Gavin was taking at a place called the Little Gym. Elijah's journey to coordination began at 9 a.m. on a Wednesday. We pulled into the parking lot of an ex-urban strip center 15 miles north of our house that 10 years before had been a pristine swath of Texas hill country. There, next to an H&R Block outlet, was the Little Gym. We walked in. Elijah was nestled in my right arm, clinging to my shoulder. I had a red nylon diaper bag slung over my other arm and a 32-ounce iced tea in my other hand. A perfectly shaped young woman bounced over to us. Her brown eyes were as wide as gumballs and seemed to be propped open with invisible toothpicks. Her legs flowed nicely from the floor into the openings in her very low-cut navy blue shorts. She wore a light blue top that carried a lovely pair of breasts that had obviously never known a day of nursing. Her hair was long and sandy brown, and she had drawn it back in a ponytail. I might have found her hot if cheerleading experience hadn't drained her demeanor of any last shred of irony. She was happily aware of her own ridiculousness. This was Miss Stephanie, Elijah's little gym instructor. "Well, who are you?" she said, addressing the kid. "Elijah," I said. She breathed in quickly. "Hi, Elijah!" Elijah recoiled into my shoulder in terror. Miss Stephanie told us to take off our shoes and sanitize our hands. Class was about to begin. There were a dozen kids in the class, most of whom seemed to be named after L.L. Bean colors. We had Ainsley and Paisley and Sydney. Miss Stephanie had us all lie on our bellies on the big red floor mat. She informed us that in little gym terminology, students at this class level were called beasties. Next, she taught us the welcome song, which went to the tune of "If You're Happy and You Know It." "Sing along, beasties," she said. Not one of the kids, as far as I could tell, sang the song during any week of the class. Instead, Miss Stephanie sang enthusiastically, though not particularly on key, and the rest of us adults mumbled through the lyrics with little enthusiasm. It went, "How do you do, big beasts? How do you do?" We slapped the mat twice with open palms. "How do you do, big beasts? How do you do?" When that horror ended, Miss Stephanie forced us onto our feet for the warm-up, which mostly involved running in a circle. This was the part of the class Elijah enjoyed most. Any beneficial effects for me were diminished by the music that Miss Stephanie played. Yeah, the recording quality was equivalent to that of the little vinyl insert records that humor magazines sometimes included when I was a kid. It had tinny instrumentation that sounded very distant, with vocals that sounded like a cartoon turtle on Vicodin had recorded them. Though I tried very hard not to listen, I did absorb some of the lyrics. They went, "Run, run, run with your partner, run with your partner. All day." I moved forward blankly like an extra in a George Romero movie. I felt alienated and alone. There was only one other dad in the class wearing a t-shirt that read, "Soul Harvest." "Is that a band?" I asked. "No," he said. "It's my church youth program." There was one woman in the class who appeared to have avoided the Soul Harvest. She was prodding her little Ethan, repeatedly saying, "Jouer, Ethan, jouer." She seemed more like my type of parent. "They never play when you want them to," I said. "You speak French," she said. "Un petit peu," I said. "Oh, my God, I've been looking for another parent who speaks French for so long. What are you guys doing after class?" I said, "We're busy this month." That's also what I said to her when I ran into her later that summer at the grocery store. Much of the gym equipment had interchangeable parts, and Miss Stephanie rearranged it every week. But Elijah wasn't particularly into any of the activities. No permutation seemed to appeal to him. One morning, Miss Stephanie set up the furniture so that kids could climb some foam stairs onto a high mat. Elijah chose instead to crawl up and then to back carefully down. Alternately, he wouldn't hang from bars or use the vault. He also spent the entire hour crawling in and out of the same tunnel. Sometimes, I think that sentence got edited in the final draft of the book. If we had It happens when you write books sometimes. If we had a jumping exercise, he'd stand there, not jumping, until Miss Stephanie lifted him up and landed him again on his feet. Even then, he'd buckle into a blob on the mat. "Great job, Elijah," she said. I thought the same thing, though I was mostly proud of him for not doing what she'd wanted. One morning, after another useless warm-up, Miss Stephanie went to a corner of the room by the plate glass windows that overlooked the parking lot. "Okay, Beastie," she said. "Today we're going to work on a special piece of equipment. It's called the balance beam." "Fabulous," I thought. "Parents," she said, "grab your beasties." I did as I was instructed. "Now I want you to lift your beasties up," she said. Again, I obeyed. Elijah's knees immediately turned to seaweed. "Today, we're going to practice walking on the balance beam," she said. "And to do that, we're going to sing a very special song. And the name of that song is Ride the Brown Pony. I want you to hold on to your beastie's hands while they walk," she said. "Here we go," she sang. "Clippity-clop, clippity-clop, ride the brown pony." I turned to the mother next to me. "I guess it's better than riding the white pony," I said. "Eh," she said. She looked at me like I was a guy who just cut her off in traffic. Admittedly, I hadn't shaved in a week and was wearing a dirty Cubs hat and a t-shirt depicting the Thing from the Fantastic Four. But I was still at the little gym, and I was still a dad. For pity's sake, couldn't a guy make a cocaine joke in mixed company anymore? Was there no other parent in this place who thought it was ridiculous that a dozen grown people were guiding kids who could barely walk across a balance beam while singing a song called Ride the Brown Pony? "Now, Beastie," said Miss Stephanie, "I want you to straddle the brown pony." And scene. These delightful tales of parenthood really never end, and I continue to chronicle my life with Elijah on my blog, because it's actually mandatory. Congress actually just passed an act that makes it mandatory for every American to have a blog. So if you guys haven't started one yet, you need to do it immediately. Within the next couple of weeks, there's a little bit of grandfather time. But I have a blog, and it's called Alternadad, believe it or not. And it's at neilpollack.com, NEALPOLLACK.com. In the blog, you find my family recently relocated to Los Angeles, where I am continuing to attempt to raise my son. And I'm going to read one of my postings. "I picked Elijah up from school yesterday, and I brought Hercules with me." Hercules is my Boston Terrier. Regina was having a General Foods International Coffee Day with another painter who she met online, and I wanted to give her a little extra time. Together, the boys and I drove to the Silver Lake Dog Park, about which Elijah complained mightily. "I don't want to go to the dog park," he said in the car. "But we're going," I said, "because Hercules needs to run around with his friends." "No," he said, "the dogs will jump on me. Then they will bite me. And they have sharp nails." "Oh, don't be such a wuss," I said. "You'll be fine." "Daddy," he said, "will you carry me?" "I will put you on top of a table," I said, "and then I will guard you with my life. Will that be sufficient?" "Yeah. What's Herky going to do?" "Run around," I said. "Is he going to eat rabbits?" Elijah asked. "Or is there going to be a sea monster there?" And so goes every conversation I have with the boy. We went to the dog park, where Hercules got it on with a Malamute pup, two Scotties, and a three-legged bitch stray. Then we went to the kid park, which was part of a city rec center. Elijah played around for a while. I ran into a mother who I'd met at a party, and we chatted noncommittally about how difficult it is to get an agent to read a spec sitcom pilot, a conversation that I rarely have with mothers anywhere else. Elijah played with her 7-year-old daughter, Isabella. The boy has a quality that makes slightly older girls want to take him under their wing. When he's 16, I predict, he will take a job as a bellhop in a luxury hotel. And at that point, his powers will begin to come in very handy. Casanova ran up to me and shouted, "My butt hurts because I have gas." And then he ran away. "Aw," said the mom, "it's cute that he tells you when he has gas." "It's no big deal," I said. "All Jews do that." It got less cute when he ran up to me and said, "I have poopy, Daddy." Isabella's mom began to back away, and she did it even more quickly when I loudly announced that I'd forgotten to bring a diaper to the park with me. I had one back in the car, a leftover Disney Princess's pink pull-up number that my father had accidentally purchased for Elijah, but I had no wipes. It was time to approach a rec center employee. "My son has to use the potty," I lied. She led us into a park bathroom. "I have a dog," I asked. "Is it okay?" "I have a dog," I said. "Is it okay if I bring him in?" "Oh, sure," she said. The fact that she would allow me to do it made me uneasy, but I took Hercules in the bathroom with me anyway and tied his leash to a faucet handle. Then I pulled down Elijah's pants, unfastened his diaper, gently lowered it with the precision of a nip-tuck surgeon, lifted it back up, tipped it over, and tumbled some magic nugs into the can. Then I had to pick up the 3 pieces of crap I had accidentally dropped onto the floor. For those of you who are planning to have children, welcome to the rest of your life. Parenthood has many payoffs, but where you once would have been getting high and watching Cartoon Network in the early evening, now you will be picking up human poop from the floor of a Parks and Center recreation restroom. Back at the car, I opened the door and turned away to fish the Disney princess's diaper out from under an Etch-a-Sketch. "Oh, how cute," I heard a female voice say. Elijah stood in the middle of the sidewalk. He dropped his pants to his ankles and was gazing at me with a death-knelling gaze of pure beatific innocence. I knew it was an act, but that's the way he behaves around the ladies. 2 young women, almost certainly actresses, were running their hands through his hair. He just smiled, naked from the waist down, and took it. I hurried over. "My apologies," I said. "Oh, please," said one of the ladies. "He's the most adorable thing ever." "Yeah, I guess it's better him than me doing that, huh?" I said. Yeah, she said. "I would say so." "It's a family trait," I said. I was joking, but I must have sounded lurky because they backed away. Elijah saw the diaper. He put his hands to his face. "No," he said, "I don't want a woman diaper." At that moment, I knew we'd reached the dread Rubicon of gender awareness. We've reached a point in the evening where I could either take questions or I could pull out another Elijah story from my magic folder. I don't know. What do you guys think? What would you rather? Would you like to hear a little bit more? Okay. I'm getting the sense from this particular audience that contemporary Elijah is slightly funnier to you than alternate Elijah in this book. After all, this book is largely about me, whereas the blog is largely about him because he can talk now. So if you will just bear with me for 1 second, I'm going to go into the back and I will pull another story out of my backpack. And please don't leave. It'll be good. I promise. I'm back. Please, refrain from applause. I can save it till the end. I have 2 pieces here, one of which is actually is a little rough, so I actually tell it better as a story. So I'm going to tell you a little story about my son, and then I'm going to read one more thing about him. It was a few months ago, and my wife had escaped had gone to Santa Fe, New Mexico for another ridiculous bourgeois art weekend with some of her friends, and they were gonna drink coffee and look at art and talk, and she left me with Elijah for several days. We don't have help, so which is fine. We don't need help. So I had him by myself for 4 days, and it was pretty tiring. On the morning of the fourth day, Sunday morning, about 7 a.m., 7:05 a.m., something like that, I woke up to him crawling into my bedroom, meowing very loudly. And I kind of looked up groggily, and he looked at me, and he said, "Daddy, I'm a cat." And I said, "I can see that. So why don't you go meow into the living room, and I'll watch TV, and I'll be there in about a half an hour." And he said, "Okay, but I have to go use the litter box first." Now, we actually have cats, and I know my kid. So I said to him, "Elijah, if you go anywhere near that litter box, you will never have a play date with anyone ever again for the rest of your life." And so he said, "Okay, Daddy." And a few minutes later, 5, 10 minutes, I don't know, because I was still basically asleep. He comes into the bedroom with his barrel of monkeys. Y'all, you know what a barrel of monkeys is? It's a, you know, childhood red plastic toy that's full of monkeys that link together. You'll have one soon, young fella. And he comes in, he holds it up in front of me and says, "Daddy, this is my litter box." And I was like, "All right, that's your litter box. Great. Go watch Dora and play with yourself or something. I don't know. I'll be out in a little while." So maybe 20 minutes later, I stumble out into the living room, in my underwear, stinking to high heaven, I'm sure. And, he's sitting on the couch and, with just this evil grin on his face. And the barrel of monkeys is on the coffee table, and he points at it. He sort of like points at it like, you know, "You should come over here and look at this." So I go over to the barrel of monkeys and I look at it, and it's full to the brim with warm piss. And I looked at him, I was like, "Elijah, God damn it, don't pee in your barrel of monkeys ever again." And sure enough, he didn't ever do that again. Not like he ever would, you know, he got me once. So then I went to the bathroom and I dumped the pee into the toilet, and then I put the barrel of monkeys in the dishwasher because he wanted to play with it later. That was the first thing I did on a Sunday. So, I don't know. I mean, I guess all kids do stuff like that. She never did, right? Now my kid is I liken him to Dennis the Menace as written by John Waters. You know, I'm sure the talking a-hole is coming. I'm sure of it. It's almost a certainty. I really can't let him see Pink Flamingos ever. Because he'll be like, "Yes, that's what I want to do. I want to live in a trailer with a transsexual." Or be a transsexual living in a trailer. He's got that in him. You know, and I'm sort of proud of that, I guess. As long as he can turn it into art. This summer, I took Elijah to the Museum of Natural History for a week, for day camp, for forest camp. It's actually a very nice camp. They have generations of, there are a lot of moms there who would, been to camp themselves as kids, and now we're taking their kids to forest camp. You know, it's a great museum, and they take them to all different parts of the museum and show them. In this particular week, they're showing them different forests. You know, there are kelp forests and rainforests and, you know, deciduous forests, et cetera, et cetera. I took him a couple of days, and we had some experiences. The teacher passed out a picture of undersea life because this was Kelp Forest Day and the kids were supposed to color. Amazingly, many of the moms in the class took the pictures away from their kids and did the work themselves. Are their lives so empty, I thought, that they have to do their kids' craft projects for them? Does it really matter whether the fish are colored properly or not? And here I thought that the Uber mom was a near-extinct breed. Good God, this class was full of the beasts. My attitude translated to Elijah's project. He scribbled on the page with brown crayon for about 5 seconds. Then he grabbed a scissors from the project box, along with a stray sheet of paper, and dove under the table. The mother next to me made a tisk sound. "Elijah doesn't set much of an example," I said good-naturedly. But whereas a normal person would say, "Oh, he's just being a kid," this woman turned to her son and said, "That's okay. My Roger knows what he's supposed to do, what he's not supposed to do. Isn't that right, Roger?" I thought, "Yeah, lady, it's so damn awful that my son is sitting under a table. Screw you!" When Elijah emerged, this mom decided it was time to show off Roger's extensive knowledge of undersea life. "What kind of fish is that, Roger?" she asked, pointing to a fish on the piece of paper. "A Garibaldi," Roger said. "Good boy. I could match her. Elijah knows hundreds of types of fish, and has for a while." "What kind of fish is that, Elijah?" I said, pointing to a difficult example that I was certain he could identify. "Poo-poo fish," he said. "Great." "Roger used to call things poo-poo," said the mom. "When he was 2. A foul blackness descended over my soul. "He used to think it was so funny," she said. "But he and his friends all know now that there are different ways to be funny. What do you say now instead of poo-poo, Roger?" "Silly fish," Roger said. "Oh, yeah, Roger," I thought. "You're hilarious." "Poo-poo fish," Elijah said again. "That's right, Elijah," I said. "That's a poo-poo fish." It came up during class that kelp is a kind of seaweed, and that seaweed is used to make sushi, because I guess it's impossible to bring up seaweed among the social class of people who can afford to send their kids to forest camp without also bringing up sushi. I made one last attempt at making nice with Roger's mom. God knows why. "You're from Pasadena, right?" I said. "Uh-huh," she said. "We've taken Elijah to that place where there's sushi on the boats, you know, on Colorado Boulevard. He has fun." "Oh," she said, "we don't think that place has enough vegetarian options, do we, Roger?" "No." "No," Roger said. "We're vegetarians." "Lucky you," I thought. "But I know that some people like it there," she said. I thought, "All right, you condescending, pathetic Gen X suburban house wench. You're going to get it now." "Elijah eats shrimp," I said, "with the heads on." I leaned toward her and whispered, so I wouldn't offend little Roger's delicate sensibilities, "And he effing loves it. He even eats the eyes." Elijah had my back. "The eyes are yummy and squishy," he added. I don't think we'll be having a play date with Roger anytime soon. All right. That's about enough of that. I'm ready to field a torrent of questions from the audience if you all have any. Turn those lights down, yeah. Play the Barry White. baby, let's talk about parenting. There's a volunteer for the library who has a microphone in case anyone wants to know anything about Alternidad, which is for sale upstairs, or parenting in general. I'm kind of an expert in a way. I'm sort of a Dr. Phil type. If I can answer any questions you have, or you know, if you want to, you got one. That's good.
Well, it's great to hear you be very enthusiastic about being a father and having a son.
I got no choice.
Well, no. So how would you compare your fathering to what your father gave you? I like the fact that you said no matter what he did, as long as he turns it into art, I think that's really cool. So.
Yeah. I mean, compared to my father, I'm home all the time. It's not like my dad was absent. I mean, he went to an office job, but you know, I can't say that like daddy wasn't there, but he wasn't. He didn't play as active a role in my upbringing as I do with Elijah. I mean, my wife and I both work at home, and so there's really and once he got off of the breast, there's no distinction between father and mother. You know, there's none at all. So I think my role is a lot more nurturing than my dad's, and I'm also like a lot sillier than my dad was, and I have. I don't know, just a lot more cultural interests. You know, my dad, God bless him, you know, pretty much only watches John Wayne movies. He also watches karate movies while gnawing a ham hock on the couch in his underwear. He's a son of German immigrants. You know, I think he was kind of like a stronger male presence. You know, I'm not exactly that in Elijah's life. But I don't know. I mean, I could have been a different kind of kid, but, you know, because of the way he is, like, he and I are more buddies than my dad and I ever were. And I'm sure we will continue to be that way to some extent, just because we do have a lot. Our sense of humors are very, very similar. And I don't know. I I'm a lot more interested in music and literature and art and other kinds of things, which isn't a knock on my dad. It's just, like, in addition to my wife, I'm exposing Elijah to that stuff. So, you know, there's some substantial differences. And I think it's generational. I mean, I'm sure some of us had, you know, artsy fartsy dads, but I think it's more common among this generation of parents to have, you know, stay at home dads who are, you know, carrying an equal or almost equal, you know, amount of the parenting burden. I've actually thought about that. See, surprise. Anyone else interested? He asked how having a son has impacted me in my life. Well, I mean, obviously there's been a reordering of priorities to some extent, but I definitely can. I mean, I think that, I spend less time gallivanting around, you know, acting like an idiot. Although I certainly don't spend no time gallivanting around acting like an idiot. And I was determined when I became a dad to continue to retain a sense of my pre-fatherhood self. And my wife was also hellbound to do the same thing. You know, we've made obviously serious adjustments, but I don't know if it really has impact. I mean, it obviously it's changed my list of things I have to do during the day, and I don't sleep late anymore, and you know, I have to deal with a lot more bureaucracy than I used to, and I also have a new best friend, which was kind of nice. But I don't know if I'm really that different of a guy. You know, I still listen to loud music. I still smoke pot. I still offend people for no reason in public. So on the one hand, you know, it's been a transition and a transformation. And on the other hand, it feels very natural, and I feel like I'm really not that different at all. Was that a cop out? I don't know. That's the way I feel.
Hi.
Hey.
You've been getting pretty good reviews.
Yes, thank God, for once.
All right. My question is, how old do you think he'll have to be before he's able to make his first mixtape for the car?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, we could do one now. You know, he doesn't have the technical skills, but, you know, he already picks and chooses the songs I play for him. You know, there are certain ones he likes and doesn't like, and I just knock them off the iPod. But in terms of, like, having his own, I don't know, I mean, 7, 8.
And do you think when he finally meets a girl, do you think you're going to actually...
When he meets a girl every day, man,
Are you going to help him make the mixtape, or is he going to be able to do it by himself?
Well, I mean, I'll certainly help him if he asks me to. I'm not going to tell him what to play for the girls, though. I mean, he'll know better than I do at that point. right now, he mostly listens to we have two kinds of music we're listening to at the moment. One is in the car. We're listening to mostly like kind of funny country singer songwriter stuff. Columbia House put out a Johnny Cash children's album last year. That's really cool and really fun. And parents, if you like Johnny Cash, you should pick it up. And because you'll enjoy it too. And we also listen to an album called Tom T. Hall Sings Songs for Kids. Tom T. Hall is like a 70s country singer-songwriter, and it's really good. And we listen to Roger Miller, the composer of King of the Road and You Can't Roller Skate in a Buffalo Herd, among other classics. At home, it's more rockin'. We have like a dance time that I use to sort of wear him out and help him go to sleep easier. We listen to a lot of garage rock. Surfin' Bird is a favorite, if y'all are familiar with that one. I don't know. I find like wacky old garage rock songs about monsters or outer space, and we dance to those. So hopefully that's not what he's playing for the girls, but you know, he could also end up being a huge nerd, so it's possible. Or boys. He could play for the boys too, you know, or both. It's LA, you know, could go either way. Yes.
Have you thought about at what point in his life or like things in his life it might be kind of an invasion of his privacy to be writing about? Or are you just going to keep going with it?
I'm going to keep going until people stop enjoying it. You know, and I mean, he likes it. You know, he we were at a coffee shop and somebody recognized him and he thought that was the coolest thing he'd ever, you know, he was like, yeah. So I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say when it will be an invasion of his privacy. You know, I could say, well, dude, it pays the bills. So, you know, you find something else for me to write about and then I'll do it. But or, you know, if it really disturbs him, I'll consider it. But, you know, for now, it doesn't. It's fine.
Have you, like, envisioned, like, conversations you'll have with him when he's an adult about this?
You know, the thing is that... Yeah, you can sort of see these stories as being embarrassing on the surface, but if you read them collectively, he's sort of a... I write about him with such love and understand. I don't know, and he's sort of like he's like the hero of my writing. He's the protagonist of it, and I, you know, he's like a I sort of see him as being like a, you know, Huckleberry Finn type kid. You know, it's like he's got so much energy and vivaciousness and life and imagination. I hope he can see himself that way, too, when he reads it. I certainly know that's how people who enjoy the writing, particularly on the website, see him. And, you know, he's just such a great kid that I don't know how he could feel bad about this portrayal of him. There are some things that, you know, there are some things that I do leave out because it might be embarrassing for him later. But I don't consider the fact that he likes to hump his car seat embarrassing. I told him to stop, and he's like, but I love it. I was like, I'm sure you do. We all do. But, you know, yeah, one day Regina and I came in the living room. We found him. He was sitting on the couch naked playing with himself while watching Dora the Explorer. Which, you know, I mean, I hope there aren't grown men who do it, but I could see why there would be, you know. I mean, everyone's got their own quirks, you know, kinks. And we told him, we said, Elijah, don't listen to this, dear. The babies are too small to understand. We said, Elijah, it's okay that you do that. In fact, it's perfectly natural and wonderful that you're doing that. But do it by yourself in private when you're in your bedroom and we're not watching. And then he said, okay, or I could do it in the bathtub. And then we were like, yeah, all right, you could do it in the bathtub. It makes a lot of sense. So I don't know why I brought that up, but I just thought it's always a winner. Yes?
I'm sorry, I came in late because I was, you know, cooking dinner and all that stuff. But how old is Elijah?
He's four now.
He's four. And I'm just, you know, I'm listening to you talk about certain things, and that age-wise it seems, you know, fine at this point for certain things. And I was interested in the fact that you brought up, you know, the pot smoking and stuff like that. I mean, do you smoke pot in front of him?
No.
And when he gets a little bit older, like I have a 10-year-old, and he asks a lot of questions about our previous behavior, our sexual behavior, our, you know, drug doing and all those kinds of things. And I'm just wondering how you feel about, you know, what you're going to share with him when he gets to be a little bit older than he is now.
Well, he's going to be able to read the book for one thing. And there are plenty of sort of fear and loathing in toddler land stories in the book. So there's that. But I don't know. I mean, I just think, you know, my parents always were not big partiers, but they always had a really sort of laid back attitude about drugs and sex. And it actually caused my sisters and I to be a little bit more on the straight and narrow and not, you know, hung up about it. And so we didn't have problems when we were kids. When he asks, I'll probably be as honest as I can be about it, you know, and I will tell him explicitly that, you know, it's not for him to do. And the thing is, like, and it's not even illegal where I live, you know, I have a medical marijuana passport prescription, so I don't even have the it's against the law rule, but I will, you know, I really have no idea what I'm going to say, honestly. I will cross that bridge when I come to it. Right now he's four and it doesn't matter. You know, it's not any concern to his, but I'm not going to do it with him, and I'm not going to encourage him to do it. I mean, I'm an adult, and I am free to make my own choices and my own mistakes, and I can at least say that to him. And that may be controversial to say, but, you know, I know plenty of other parents who have the same, you know, sort of basically benign habit that I do that somehow get their kids through teenagehood without turning them into junkies. So I'll figure it out. Does that answer seem somewhat non-committal to you somehow? I just don't know. I don't know. You know, I mean, I could be completely different by then. I could be completely uninterested in it and it won't matter. I could be, you know, a fundamentalist, you know, I could be a fundamentalist Christian preacher. You know, it's possible. Anything's possible. Oh, and yeah, I mean, actually, I'm kind of curious, like, if any of you have kids, you know, and if you had to deal with that. I mean, what do you tell your kid when that stuff comes up?
You know, since you did the same thing, you know. And my sister was, you know, valedictorian of her class and smoked pot and drank a lot.
Well, there we go, right?
Right. And I said, don't you think that, you know, telling her that it's so bad, you know, to do is a little hypocritical? And, you know, wouldn't you be a completely different person if you hadn't had those experiences that you did, you know? So why are you making such a negative thing about it? And she says, well, you know, it is illegal. And I said, well, it was illegal when we did it too, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's the thing. I think that don't go telling him that it's awesome and that he should do it. I think that's probably a mistake. That would definitely be a mistake. But I don't know. I think that just being as forthright as you can. The one thing I would say, and I've already set this up, is like, you know, do not do it and drive, and do not do it and get in a car with anyone else who's been doing it. You know, I mean, that seems like a sane advice. I mean, if you do it, do not go anywhere near a motor vehicle. I mean, does that seem wrong? You got to say that, right? I follow that myself.
Well, I mean, the other thing is that, you know, you kind of knowing your kid, like, what are they going to do with the information that you give them? One kid of mine would be totally fine to tell. The other one, I'm not so sure how she would deal with it. So that's
again, he's four, you know, and so I will have to gauge the situation when it gets to be time. You know, right now he asks me questions like, Daddy, what's going to happen when the earth blows up? Where are all the people going to go? Are they going to turn into monkeys? Are the monkeys going to turn into people? Are the dinosaurs going to come back? I'm like, have you been smoking pot? Those are the kinds of questions I have to deal with now. And I guess I can just make it. I can say whatever I want. It's kind of awesome in a way. But at least I'm glad he sort of understands the concept of evolution. Yeah, I'm an idiot. You know, I guess all parents just do the best they can with their very limited knowledge and experience. Anyone else have any questions, comments, tomatoes to throw? Yes?
So why did you leave Philly and why did you leave Texas?
Why did I leave Philly? It just wasn't work. I mean, I like Philly, but it just wasn't working for us here. And I don't know. I really loved Austin, Texas, and I wanted to give it a shot. I figured, like, we hadn't had the baby yet, so I wanted to have one last go. I moved to Philly because I thought I needed to be on the East Coast to further my literary career. And as it turned out, no, nothing was going to further my literary career except for writing books. I left some ambitions in various toilet bowls here and went to Texas. And then I moved from Austin to Los Angeles because I wanted to get into the motion picture business. Basically, and alternative has been optioned for a movie, and I wrote a screenplay, and that screenplay has since been deposited in waste baskets all over town. But I don't know, but it still got a chance of being made into a movie. So I moved to LA for a very specific career reason, and I think we're going to stay there because I have a lot of family there. My sister lives there with her kids, and aunt and uncle are there. My parents live nearby in Phoenix, so I think it's California is kind of a permanent home. You know, we were just kind of roaming around looking for a place, you know, to call home. We didn't really have any place. We, you know, she was from Nashville. We didn't want to live there. I didn't want to live in Phoenix where I'd grown up. So we were looking for a home. And, you know, Philly just wasn't it at the time.
Do you have more kids planned?
No. No, we're getting another dog, though. we're adopting another Boston Terrier. In fact, as soon as I get back from my tour, we have to have an appointment to go meet him at the place he's been staying, his foster home. His name is Shaq. So, it's a nice ironic Boston Terrier name. It'll go well with Hercules. Apparently he has a slightly arthritic hip. But yeah, no, I mean, I guess it's possible we could have another kid, but, one of the major themes of the book is that, you know, kids are a big financial burden, and you know, unless we're more financially secure, I really don't want to have to go through the stress of it again. You know, I mean, the early years with Elijah were tough. We had crappy health insurance, lived in terrible neighborhoods, had trouble finding good daycare. You know, the problems that a lot of new parents go through. But I really, you know, the sort of that baseline support system for middle class families seems weaker than ever right now. You know, when I was growing up, you know, my dad made about the same amount of money I do now, but I mean, it was guaranteed that I was going to go to a good public school and have, you know, good doctors and, you know, live in a safe neighborhood, you know, whereas I had to form a neighborhood association in Austin because there were two guys fighting over a prostitute under my son's bedroom window one night, you know? And I certainly didn't move to that neighborhood because I thought it would be cool. You know, it's just where we could afford to live. So, you know, where we're living in L.A. is only slightly better. Don't move to L.A. if you're looking for a nice, safe, calm, clean place to raise your kid. That's the lesson to be learned from my experience. But, you know, someday we'll live in a gated community where no one can hurt us. Any other questions? Comments? Yes?
It's a lot of fun when you introduce new superheroes that
Oh, you read the blog. I see.
To
catch you all up who aren't intimately familiar with the vagaries of my son's imagination, Elijah has an entire universe of imaginary superheroes that he's created. I call it the Elijahverse, and the hero of the Elijahverse is Hot Man, who has hot power that he shoots out of his finger, but he also has all kinds of other powers. And he wears a costume that features a fire-breathing dragon on his chest, except for when he gets sick, and then the costume changes, and he turns into an old knight who has a snake that has fire coming out of its butt. So Hot Man's the hero of the Elijahverse. He's the one Elijah talks about the most. So, I mean, he kind of, you know, and he lives on Venus, but also has a condo in Chicago. You know, how can you not love Hot Man? But I actually really, I like his arch enemy, Dr. Boney, who is an old robot who has blood on the outside and skin on the inside, and 18 children. He's very, very evil, is Dr. Boney. Hot Man doesn't have any kids, but he does have three pets, two cats. One of them is named Electricity. The other one's named Tyrone, and then a dog named Pillow, who in fact is with me on this trip. Apparently, Hot Man is not with me on this leg of the trip. He's going when I go to the West Coast. He's coming with me. Elijah told me that he wasn't going to be able to come to Boston and Philly and New York with me because it'd be too cold. So instead, he's going to Minneapolis. Elijah's never been to Minneapolis, so he doesn't quite understand. Those are the sort of the main characters. Which one's your favorite? You like Hot Man? Well, here's another thing about Hot Man. His name is spelled Bhotman. Elijah insists that Hot Man starts with a B. And Regina was fighting him about this because, you know, she had to write, she wanted to be Hot Man for Halloween, which is actually his birthday as well. And she wanted to put Hot Man, you know, she was trying to write Hot Man. She's like, no, he's like, no, there's a B. It starts with a B. And she's like, no, Elijah, Hot Man does not start with a B. And I was like, Regina, just let it start with a B. The B. Let's just say the B is silent. So his superhero motto is Hot Man, the B is silent. Then there are other sort of more minor heroes in the pantheon. There's Hillman, who is actually a mountain, who fights crime, but mostly he sort of performs like the function of like Batman or the Oracle. You know, he sort of tracks criminals through a series of supercomputers that he has inside of him. And then let's see, there's Mr. Dang, who I haven't been able to figure out at all. Who are some, I'm kind of blanking here. It's mostly about Hot Man and Dr. Boney, but, you know, it's amazing to me that this kid has, you know, his imagination is so incredible. And, you know, and this, the fact that he just, you know, will drive for, you know, a half an hour and he'll just sit there and just tell me stories about these superheroes. And it's, you know, it's like I'm on acid all the time. Or he is. Or both of us. I don't know. It's pretty great, actually. Yes?
The internet wasn't around when we were kids.
No.
Did it kind of scare you that kids going to be growing up with that?
No. I think I'm sure there are, I know there are dangers, but I think it's greatly exaggerated by people, adults who don't spend that much time on the internet. I know that there are predators out there, but, you know, I mean, what am I going to do? Keep my kid off the internet? The world has gone completely online. I mean, You know, I can't even begin to imagine how I'm going to keep him away from that. What I hate, though, is that parents are like, oh, we have to teach our kids about computers. I'm like, they're three. You don't have to teach them about computers. You need to teach them about bugs and flowers and, you know, sand. You know, and it's like I've got – I mean, no offense to my sister and brother-in-law, but I've got a niece who, like, spends a lot of time on the computer, but all she does is point and click at the Playhouse Disney website. And I'm like, do you really need to, like, spend more time with the Wiggles? You know, do you really need to, you know, play interactive games with characters who brainwash you 10 hours a day anyway? You know, and I think that's what a lot, you know, that's what a lot of, you know, computers for kids are at the moment. So, you know, whatever the, I feel like people treat, like, the internet, you know, and kids now, like, they kind of, like rock and roll kids in the 50s. You know, it's just part of their DNA at this point. And, you know, what are you going to do? I'll just be like, Elijah, don't answer any emails from creepy men who want to send you pictures of themselves. You know? What, you know, just don't do it, you know? And then, you know, because mostly the internet is pretty benign. Wait, there's a lot of porn on the internet, isn't there? Man, you know, can I stop now? We're like, your mother and I believe that porn should be legal, but no, that's not going to work either. What would you do?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't either.
I'm not scared of the internet.
I'm not. Yeah, that's the thing. It's like the internet is I think it's mostly benign. You know, I'm not really that worried about it. Yeah, you could have found out anything before anyway. You just needed to work. Oh, well, God forbid you'd have had to read a book or something. I think that's great, you know. You know, hopefully he'll use it wisely and won't just use it to chat with his friends. God forbid. Yes? Yes, of course. Everybody has a blog. Everybody gets a blog. You get a blog. You get a blog. That's my Oprah joke. I would like nothing more than to, like, pass down the mantle to him. You know, I hope he would be able to, to do it. Yeah. And with a good sense of humor. You know, I'd love that. I think it'd be hilarious. It'd be hilarious when, you know, can't read or write yet. But when he does learn to read or write, I would be like, why don't you do a post today? Do a guest post. You know, tell people what you did today. Right now, if he did a guest post, he'd be like, you know, he gets kind of shy. He'd be like, I ate a bagel with butter and cream cheese. He doesn't quite understand how interesting he actually is. But yeah, I would love it. I'd be very proud of him if he had a blog. Anyone else? All right. Well, I think we'll cut it short there, and I'll be upstairs signing books in a little bit. Thank you so much for coming. Hope you had a good time. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.